We do have this room till 5:30, so I'm sure we'll have some very good discussions. But first, before we start on the Senate File 1069, I have a little movement I would like to make with Senate File 1194, which is the Reliability Administrator Modification. And this is a department bill. And I had it in front of this committee and just laid it over on the table before. We have a delete all amendment I'd like to propose. And if acceptable, I'd like to then send it to the floor. Okay? So we are going to have a quorum here fairly shortly. As soon as Senator Burks gets to his chair, we'll have a quorum. But I'd like to move the A5 amendment. Oh, excuse me. I first have to take the bill off the table. Well, these guys have got to get it together here. Okay, it's before us. So. All right, we have Senate File 1194 in front of us. And I'd like to move the A5 amendment. And before we vote on it, I'll just explain this delete all amendment. And basically, and you should have that in your packets, member. Is that right?
Yes,
you have it?
Tim.
Okay. The as we introduced it, it merged the Reliability Administrator Office into the Energy Intervention Office. Subdivision 3A, the regional national duties, would actually place the general powers and duties, places the regional and national duties within the Department of Commerce. And this is the language that the Commerce needs to intervene on behalf of Minnesota when dealing with the MISO or the FERC on regional and national international issues. And then subdivision 3B is moves the assessment language to 216B.62, where all the utility assessments are located. And it keeps the sunset out at 2016, which was agreed upon. Section 3 repeals the Reliability Administrator Office and the Energy Intervention Office. And this has been agreed upon language from Bill Grant and his department. And I'm not sure if they would like to come up and say a few words. Director Grant?
Madam Chair and members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And thank you for opportunity to make a few brief remarks on this. As I think members know, Minnesota is part of a regional and national power system. There are a number of decisions affecting Minnesota at the regional and federal levels, and that activity continues to increase. And in order to ensure that our costs don't go up and that we don't lose regulatory control over our own power facilities, it's critical that Minnesota be represented in these various fora. And so what Senate File 1194 does is really streamline the authority that already existed in statute for the department to be involved in these matters. It collapses a couple of areas of statute, as Senator Rosen explained, and it extends the assessment authority that allows us to continue to play this role. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that members might
have. Thank you, Director Van. Any questions? Or Director Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear on what this does. So the amendment is a delete everything. So we're no longer establishing the Energy Reliability and Intervention Office. We're just keeping the Energy Issues Intervention, or are we changing the name? Or
that's right. Senator McGuire, you came on after all this, didn't you?
I did,
yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. Director Grant, would you like to answer that?
Senator Rosen and Senator McGuire. That's right. We don't feel that it's necessary any longer to have a designated office or a designated person called the Reliability Administrator. This will be a function within our regulatory unit. It's presently being done by a variety of people. We're hoping to kind of focus that activity in one staff person with help from others, but there's no need to have a person running around calling themselves the Reliability Administrator in our view.
Senator McGuire?
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, ma'am.
Any other questions? Can I renew my motion for the A5 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'd like to move that Senate File 1194 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor? Senator Kublik.
Madam Chair, as amended.
As amended, thank you, Senator Cooley. You are my watchdog, and I appreciate that. I move that Senate File 1194, as amended, be recommended pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The bill is adopted. Thank you. With that, members, we will move on to Senate File 1069. This is a bill from Senator Howe. And this is an informational hearing, Senator Howe, as agreed upon.
Thank you.
We have a long list of testifiers, and like I said, we have a lot to do today. So we are going to be giving So Senate File 1069 needs to be complete by 4:15, so we have exactly an hour. And I think that's fair. That leaves 20 minutes for the opposition, 20 minutes for the proponents, and then general discussion amongst us all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, thank you for granting us this informational hearing. This bill, Senate File 1069, is about allowing local control to counties to provide ordinances concerning setbacks and siting of wind energy. And with me today, I have several testifiers, and I'll start with Christy Rosenquist.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Rosenquist. Please state your name.
My name is Christy Rosenquist. I live in rural Goodhue County.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Rosen. The bill allows for a half mile of setback from property lines from owners of property who have decided not to participate in a wind energy lease with a wind company. And it specifically targets areas that have 3.5 homes per section or per square mile, which is the same thing as a section. Somewhere between 0 homes per square mile and downtown St. Paul, I believe there lies a home density at which utility-scale industrial wind turbines no longer fit. Current state standards do not address this issue at all. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commissioners have stated repeatedly in public hearings that they need guidance from the legislature on a number of issues around large wind energy conversion systems. At one Public Utilities Commission hearing, Commissioner O'Brien stated, "Even though the commission is supposed to advocate for the people, the people's concerns are not the commissioner's concerns because the commission is under pressure from the legislature to approve more wind projects in order to fulfill the renewable energy standard from 2007. Other comments from Public Utilities Commissioner. Places are all different where these projects are going to be and possibly need to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. We know that there are becoming more and more issues with industrial wind, and not every area is the same and needs to be looked at as such. When the renewable energy standard was enacted, it was not realized the ramifications that it could have on health and keeping communities vibrant. What are the regulations for wind turbines in Minnesota? The 2007 renewable energy standard exempts wind from laws regulating electrical generators, and directly and through careful construction of their land lease contracts, wind is also exempt from Minnesota laws governing agricultural land use. I asked Bill Grant, the new director of the Office of Energy Security at the Department of Commerce, why these are exempt, and he told me that the goal at the time was to install as much wind as quickly as possible to take advantage of the federal tax dollars through the federal 1603 tax grants. So the other state standards governing wind would be the setback standards, which the state contends are rigorous and the wind companies contend are rigorous, but these general siting standards are specifically written for projects under 25 megawatts, and the projects going in are mostly larger than that. In our county's examination, we were unable to identify any scientific basis for the current standards. They were written when turbines were much smaller than what's currently being installed. They provide for setbacks significantly smaller than minimum setback recommended by turbine manufacturers. They fail to consider host communities as stakeholders. And in my opinion, they fail to protect basic health, public safety, and private property rights. Quite a few counties have passed ordinances with more strict standards than what the state standards are, and in other cases, those standards have been upheld by the Public Utilities Commission. As an example of the state standards, which most counties find they need more strict standards, would include public roadway setback of 250 feet, Turbines are 400 to 500 feet tall, most of the new turbines, and they do occasionally, though rarely, fall over. So most counties have ascertained that having a turbine 250 feet from a roadway is not a good idea for public safety. General Electric, the turbine manufacturer for the turbines in the AWA Goodhue project, recommends at least an 800-foot setback for ice throw and what they refer to as component liberation, which is when parts fly off the turbine. McNelius Wind in southern Minnesota had component liberation a couple of years ago. A blade came off a turbine and stuck into the ground. Other things that can happen is a braking failure, a turbine spins out of control, the turbine collapses. This also occurred in Minnesota in Wilson Lake. The Vestas Wind Systems manufacturer specifically says do not stay within a radius of 1,300 feet from a turbine unless it is necessary. Make sure that children do not stay or play near the turbine. Under current state standards, a person who is hosting a turbine can put that turbine in a place close enough to a property line so that the other property owner would have a significant part of their property unusable because it's unsafe, according to the turbine manufacturer, to be within 1,300 feet of the turbine. So the question, I believe, is how close is too close to homes? There are currently projects proposed in Goodhue County and Stearns County that are experiencing significant public pushback. The demographics in these areas are different in two significant ways from far southern Minnesota and far southwestern Minnesota, where these projects appear to be welcome and where most property owners, from what we're being told, are happy participants with the wind companies. The home density is far higher in our area, and farm operations include a significant number of confinement dairy operations. We have raised a significant number of specific questions about electrical issues and the possibility that induced voltages are creating stray voltages and have not had a substantive answer from the state of Minnesota. Citizens have been repeatedly told that there are very few complaints by home and property owners arising from the existing utility scale wind projects in Minnesota, and this appears to be true for the most part. However, several citizens and local wind investors in far southern Minnesota and northern Iowa have also told us that they would not allow a turbine to be put closer than a mile from their residence and have expressed their opinion to us that these large utility-scale projects could never work in the more populated areas. By examining housing density in existing utility-scale wind energy projects in Minnesota, we have found that almost all of the large existing projects are sited in areas with 3 homes per square mile or less. The Bent Tree project in far southern Minnesota has a much higher home density and has faced significant opposition and is currently dealing with problems including loss of television reception. We've spoken to people living in Maurer County and Freeborn County where neighboring properties place turbines as close as 1,500 feet from their homes, and there are people there who have told us that they are forced to sleep in the basements of their homes and have other health-related issues that started coinciding with the turbines being placed close to their homes. The Minnesota noise standards are brought up repeatedly. There is a noise standard that turbines have to abide by. They're part of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency noise standards. These standards were written in the 1970s. They have no measurements or language specific to wind turbines. They do not measure or assess low-frequency noise. Low-frequency noise is the primary noise issue identified by the Minnesota Department of Health and one of only 3 recommendations put forth by the Minnesota Department of Health in Public Health Impacts of Wind Turbines, May 22, 2009. A few conclusions from the Department of Health are that wind turbines generate a broad spectrum of low-intensity noise. Sleeplessness and headache are the most common health complaints. Most available evidence suggests that reported health effects are related to low-frequency noise. The Minnesota nighttime standard appears to underweight penetration of low-frequency noise into dwellings. Low-frequency noise from a wind turbine is not easily perceived beyond 1/2 mile. They make 3 recommendations, one of which is that the state should evaluate low-frequency noise component, which the state does not do. And the Department of Health also stated any noise criteria beyond current state standards used for placement of wind turbines should reflect priorities and attitudes of the community. In the case of one local project, again, the bill speaks to non-participants, meaning people who chose not to sign a contract with a wind company. In the case of one local project, the maps and available data show that the wind developer approached about 7 out of 10 residents in the proposed project area. 1 out of 7 signed agreements. six out of seven declined to participate. They were offered money by the wind company, and they chose not to participate. This sets up a situation of 10% voluntary paid participants and 90% unpaid, unwilling, affected residents. Lincoln Township in Kawanee County, Wisconsin, appears to have found the point at which there are too many turbines too close to residences. The result in Kawanee County, Wisconsin, was that the wind company had to buy out property owners, they raised the homesteads, and people left the area. Again, at what point do utility turbines not fit? The 2007 Renewable Energy Standards and related laws removed meaningful regulatory control over industrial wind from the state. The state offered some control to counties, and the county, and very recently, the county standard of Goodhue County was examined by an administrative law judge as part of a PUC process. Her recommendation was to throw out every part of the county ordinance. At this point, I would think that a sensible recommendation would be to set a standard, a strong state standard that protects non-participating homeowners, or to turn control over to the counties. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenquist. I think we're going to wait on some questions until we get the testifiers through.
Thank you,
Senator
Madam
Howell.
Chair. Madam Chair, I have Paul Reese here now to testify.
Welcome, Mr. Reese.
Good afternoon.
State your name for the record.
Paul Reese. I'm going to speak a little bit today about our process in getting the county to pass an ordinance. We're farmers. As farmers, you need to look 6 months into the future at all times. We need planning. So, of course, when the wind developers came to the community, most of the farmers said, what does this mean long term? They're offering us money in the short term. What does it mean long term? So as we did the research, we discovered that the benefits are most likely not as great as the developers were saying, and the costs are likely far larger than what the developers were telling us. We, of course, have about three times the population density of any project that seems to work in the state. We look to the state regulatory agencies to do something. They really didn't address our concerns. We found statutory authority for the counties to enact an ordinance that the PUC must apply. So that's what we did. The residents produced an ordinance. The county decided that they were going to write their own ordinance. So they created a subcommittee to examine the issue. And they did. They identified three main issues. One is sound. One is the shadow flicker, and the other one is the stray voltage. The shadow flicker, the sound is 50 decibels is what the PCA limits your sound at. However, if there was a conversation going on in this room that you perceived at 40 decibels, you'd ask them to take it outside. Shadow flicker. When the blades obscure the sun, so you get this strobing shadow effect. If I stood by the light switch and played with it for 20 minutes, I'd probably be escorted out of here in handcuffs. But this is what the state standards are asking non-participants to put up with constantly. In our ordinance, we address that. And of course, that went to the ALJ, who she didn't quite see it like we did. She, in many places, she actually cut and pasted the briefs from the wind developers. So we are not actually being represented on the state level. Our entire goal is not to chill people who choose to participate in these projects. We want to curtail involuntary participation. We really need people to have a choice whether or not they're going to be living with these effects. I think I've taken enough time.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, now I have Dan Schleck.
Welcome, Mr. Schleck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Schleck. I am a land use attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate File 1069. I think it's important to understand that right now in the state of Minnesota, there is not very good guidance for either local municipalities, for participating landowners, for non-participating landowners, for the PUC or for the wind developers on exactly what they're supposed to do in this situation. It is being treated in many cases on a case-by-case basis, and there isn't very much consistency or predictability. And I think that the standards that are set forth in Senate File 1069 provide a lot of that predictability. I think it's important to understand what the issue is. The issue is one of nuisance. In many cases, you'll hear these projects referred to as wind farms or wind energy farms. That's somewhat of a misnomer. Be aware that these things are large industrial-scale power production facilities. They may not produce as much power as a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear power plant, but be aware that they do produce power on an industrial scale. In many cases, we're not talking about two or three turbines. We're talking about 40 to 100 and affecting large tracts of land. And it's important to not misinterpret these things as some type of agricultural use. They're not. The issue is one of compatibility of land uses, proximity of one use to another use, and the idea what is the best for the state in terms of moving forward and working with these things. And one of the things that Senate File 1069 provides is predictability, and it does provide a guidance for a lot of local municipalities and state agencies and counties that are struggling with these issues. I think it's important to understand that the idea here is to promote the idea of wind energy is the idea of renewable energy, and it is a system certainly that is important to the public as a public purpose. But I think it's also important to understand exactly what we're talking about here in terms of the arguments between what is a public use and what is a public purpose. The legislature struggled with this back in 2006 after what some of you may remember as the federal case in Connecticut called the Kelo case, and also maybe some of you are familiar with the case in Minnesota, the Walzer case, right down on 494 in Bloomington, and the idea of when can one private party's land use rights be taken away for the good of the state or the good of the federal government. This is exactly the same issue. If renewable energy is an important public purpose for the state, it certainly isn't allowed to go in and impact the private land use rights of others without some type of just compensation. And by providing the standards that are documented in Senate File 1069, there will be predictability for developers as well as land users, so that there will be less opportunities for this clash of land uses. People will plan their projects better, and it will not be such a situation whereby you will have this clash of land uses. I think it's important to understand the idea that somehow parties have testified or documented that this may have some reduced effect on wind development in the state of Minnesota. I think that that claim by anybody is really ridiculous at this point, because I think that it ignores what I'll call the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Under the Federal Stimulus Act, Section 1603, if a wind developer is able to permit a project and get it started in the ground to start to construct the project before the end of 2011, they're entitled to a 30% cash grant subsidy from the federal government. They don't have to have the project done. They don't have to be generating power. They simply have to start the project. If they miss that date and they are not able to start the project by the end of this year, they still get tax credits spread out over a series of 5 years that equal the same amount of money. But the real drive here is to get the cash grant, of course, because having money sooner is always better than having it later. So I think that the claim that somehow additional setbacks will chill wind development is absolutely based on any fact, and I think it's really a crazy notion, given what the federal stimulus package does. I think that the last thing that is important to understand is that I think there's an idea that there is local control on these projects right now. And as Ms. Rosenquist testified, and I think it's important to understand, just last Friday, the Office of Administrative Hearings came out with a decision that completely rejected a county ordinance on exactly this issue, saying that it would that there was good reason for the Public Utilities Commission to ignore that rule, even though there's science, even though there's a report by the Minnesota Department of Health that claims a half-mile setback is appropriate. The Office of Administrative Hearings has said to the PUC, go ahead and reject it. And in fact, if you read that decision in detail, what it says is all these things can be cited on a all these cases can be decided on a case by case basis. That provides no predictability either for the local communities or for the developers. But if you read the decision, that's how the Office of Administrative Hearings has interpreted the current statutes. I think it's important to understand that it's not, and I'll close with this, it's not the job of the legislature to maximize the economics of a few developers in the state. It's important to protect all the people, and as Ms. Rosenquist testified, in many cases, 9 out of 10 people that are affected by this have absolutely no direct input on how these things are cited and the potential for their impacts on their lives and the quiet use and enjoyment of their property. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schleck. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Glahn.
Madam Chair.
A few minutes left.
Madam Chair, I will be quick here. My name is Bill Glahn. I live in Edina, Minnesota. I'm here as a private citizen. But for the benefit of Senator McGuire, who's new to the committee, I will give just 10 seconds of background. I used to have Bill Grant's job as Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce in charge of the Energy Division. And within the Energy Division, we have the Facilities Permitting Group, who is charged with implementing 216F and much of the other permitting responsibilities given to the department and the PUC by the state legislature. And what we've struggled with during my time, I'll just speak for myself, what we struggled with was how to implement 216F. At what point does the wishes of the county or the local community come into play and need to be honored? And with the ambiguity that is in 216F today, is not clear. Does a county have to completely assume the permitting responsibility then to have their voice heard at the state level? Exactly what triggers that? And what I see encouraging about the bill that Senator Howe has brought forward, it recognizes that local communities will have a voice. This is very much the problem with implementing the Jeffersonian vision of local control and local government. How do you collect that voice of the people and push it on up to higher levels of government? And it's true what we have today at the state level is an opportunity for individual landowners, such as what you've heard from this morning and we'll hear more late or this afternoon and he'll hear more from, to weigh in on an issue. But they're just a single landowner or a couple of landowners together. How do you collect that voice of the local community? And what we tried to implement, at least in the last administration, was developing renewable energy projects in the state, because we saw benefits from that, in communities that welcome them. And the real trick is trying to determine whether or not a community welcomed them or not. So what I think would be useful is having a mechanism where we collect that will of the people and pass that on to the higher level of government. At the same time, as Senator Howell's bill does, recognizing that not all counties are created equal. So if in Senator Rosen in your district, or Senator Magnus isn't sitting here, but Senator Kubley's district, if there's a wind project and the local community wants it, then we should have a way of getting that done. But in the unlikely event that someone proposed one for Senator Dibble's district, his is very different in character than some of these other districts around the state, and we should have the will of the local population reflected in whatever permitting decision then gets made by the state. So I would encourage this body to consider ways in which we can have that voice of the people collected and heard in our state process and recognize that not all communities are the same and they're going to come to different conclusions. And we're not the only state to struggle with this. I know Wisconsin has struggled with this, and they have decided, at least for the time being, to have a one-size-fits-all process, and they probably have ended up where they're going to have fewer projects built as a result. So what I think would be useful for both the renewable energy industry and local communities is build in flexibility where projects that are welcomed by communities will get built, and projects that have that struggle with getting that acceptance, we have a different process for having the local communities weigh in. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Glahn. Appreciate it.
Senator
Howe.
Madam Chair, if there's any questions now.
No, I think we're going to wait. We're going to go ahead and do the proponents.
Right.
Senator Howe. So we have Mr. Ken Schaffers.
Thank you.
Thank you, and be prepared to come back up, though. sat way back there. It's hard to get out. Mr. Schaeffers, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you. My name is Ken Schaeffers. I'm a dairy farmer from Painesville, Minnesota, and I'd like to speak in opposition to the proposed legislation. I'd like to start just telling a little bit about way my qualifications might be regarding setbacks. We started looking at wind farms on our farm back in 2007 as a seabed project, and we worked at that for about a year. And one of the first things we look at, whether we can do this or not, is at the setbacks. And, of course, we're not only concerned about setbacks for construction. We're concerned about setbacks for our own well-being. And already I take issue with some of the things that were said here, is that even if there's less than three households per square mile out in Zion Township, I think we're just as important. So we should be just as far away as if there's three and a half. But from then, we were not able to make that project go. As you can see, making wind projects go is a difficult process. And about August of 2008, Geronimo Wind came to us and suggested that they were going to be working on a project in our area, and we felt it was a good idea to go with them. We are very conservation minded on our farm. We are in CSP, which is monitoring water, fertilization, manure, all these type of things. We're very in tune to not wasting and being environmentally friendly, and so a wind farm is something we really wanted to do. So it took us a while, but we did get an agreement with them. And again, the discussions are, how much land do we need? Where can we build one? Because of all the setbacks, and there are setbacks for various reasons, as you probably know. From that point, there was opposition in Stearns County, more so in other projects than in ours. But again, the county had to act as a whole. They set up an advisory council, and I served on that as a proponent of wind energy. One other person, and there was two people that were, and they don't want to say that they're opposed to wind energy. That gets to be kind of a tricky thing, but they're just opposed to it in their backyard. They think it should be in North Dakota and then run a power line across my farm and then send it to the cities. But anyway, that's a smart-ass remark. I was from the So we met. We met a lot, and we looked at setbacks. We discussed setbacks. We discussed health aspects. It was alluded today again that these setbacks that are greater, that they want greater than currently exist, are as a result of health. There's no evidence of that. Because if it was a health issue where there's a population of 3.5 or greater, that's a health issue for 3.5 or less. That makes no sense to a farmer. So I am opposed to it. Those are where we worked with. I've worked with this for about 3 years, setbacks. Why are they there? Why are they important? We live out there. We want proper ones. And I understand. And my feeling is that, you know, the state has a 500 minimum for participants. I think I like to see 1,000. Our developer says, you know, we're going to be at least 1,000 feet away. So they are sensitive to really the aesthetic issues. To me, the health aspects aren't there. We looked at many different things as to what would increased setbacks do. You have to be aware of how increased setbacks change things. They increase them a great deal. A one-half-mile setback from a residence takes out 502 acres, which in the part of the county I live, most of the farms are still 160-acre parcels. They may own more, but it's a 160-acre parcel. So you have 160-acre parcel that doesn't participate. There will be eight neighboring 160-acre parcels that cannot participate. So if we're talking about land rights and rights of the individual, my feeling is we're taking away rights there. We're next to some large livestock operations. We endure a lot of traffic and odors from that. I maintain that a wind turbine on my 160-acre parcel will be a lot less of a burden than a large livestock operation. I'll try to be sensitive to your time here. We've worked with the county. We worked through the county and with people that wanted greater setbacks. When I see how our county worked with the PUC and how the developer worked with that to meet the needs of the county, I think the communication between the county and state is good. I think it works. I think when some counties, if there are setbacks that would be excessive, I think the state should have the right to say, okay, there's no scientific basis for this. Let me just, you know, we talked about the number of people that want to participate and how that's important. In our area, there's about 100 landowners that are in what we call the footprint. Of those, 80% decided they wanted to participate and they want to put wind turbines on their property. The remaining 20%, over half of those say, I don't want to participate, but I respect my neighbor's right to. So we have less than 10% that really says, you know, I don't want to participate and I don't think my neighbor should be able to put one up either. And currently that number is actually dropping, where more people are feeling that, you know, we have a right to do these wind turbines. And that the health effects really aren't as great as they'd like to make. I guess I'll try to be sensitive to your time. If you have any questions, I'll move on and let somebody else speak.
Thank you, Mr. Sheffers. Okay. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon, John Meyer from Olmsted County. I'm a farmer there. Am involved with a potential wind farm, wanting to get my farm into the project. Would have had a lot more of the landowners that are involved around me here in support or in opposition to the bill, but in support of my statement. But it's a beautiful sunny day, and I was the one elected to leave the planner and get in here. And so it's costing me on a lot of ends here.
There's some other things going on out there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you for having me here today. If we go back to the farms of 70 years ago or more, harvesting the power of the wind for personal electricity and water pumping was an essential part of the agricultural scene on Grandpa's farm. Just as common as were horses and very small tractors, average tractor, even 60, 70 years ago was about 50 horse for a good one, a big one. Now we're running, my big tractor's 325, they're up to 550 or more. So everything has gotten bigger. In contrast, what was not common on a common part, not a common part of the agricultural scene in Grandpa's day, was the non-agricultural resident and designated zoning districts. Essentially, every one of the residents of the agricultural areas were actively involved in the common agricultural practices of the day. If a person was not, they lived in town. They couldn't commute so easily as they can today. Daily life was hard on the farm. Roads were often more mud than anything. They didn't have the conveniences, opportunities for work and play, and services of the more highly developed, higher density residential areas. As farming changed and farms got larger, small farms got bought by neighboring, larger, expanding farms. The common equipment and livestock practices necessarily became larger. And farm acreages and building sites often were sold off to non-agricultural interests rather than being raised or left abandoned. Unavoidable conflicts between agricultural interests and residential interests arose, just like they did in the cities in the years before they enforced designated zoning districts. Yes, the windmills, just like the farm equipment and livestock operations and average number of acres farmed by one farmer, have become much larger than on Grandpa's farm. But windmills are, as they always were, a part of the agricultural scene. They are not going to be built on residential property or in towns on commercial or industrial property. If we don't build them on our Minnesota farms, we're not going to build them in Minnesota at all. The language of this bill would absolutely end wind development in Minnesota. It will move out of our state, and we will be buying wind-generated power from the Dakotas, shipping it much farther on more numerous, more extensively upgraded, longer, and more hotly contested transmission lines. And we will be paying more for it. Even more disturbing and having a far greater unavoidable impact, none of those energy dollars will remain in our Minnesota economy. We will be exporting the jobs and economic development to other states and regions that could have stayed here. Every 150 megawatt wind project will result in approximately 1.2 million just in rural Minnesota landowner payments every year. Over the average lifespan of the turbines, that would be $36 million for one project. That's money that these farmers will pay taxes on and will invest again into their farms, in machinery, in parts, in buildings, in jobs and opportunities for other Minnesotans. Minnesota ranks ninth in the nation for potential wind energy development, but we are one of the closest states to the energy demand that also has excellent wind resources. We have the potential for 75,000 megawatts of wind energy. If that were fully developed, it would mean approximately $600 million annually just in rural Minnesota landowner payments flowing into the ailing rural Minnesota economy. That does not include the jobs that the industry would create, and it does not include the other opportunities for economic development created by this industry. Our Minnesota agriculturally zoned properties currently have the legal right to build wind turbines as defined by reasonable Minnesota law and as granted by our legislature. Based on unsubstantiated claims, the anti-wind movement is now demanding unjustified and unreasonable protection. They want you and the legislature to grant them new and far-reaching property rights that extend a half mile beyond their own property boundary, in favor of their private residential interests in an agricultural zone, and stripping current legislatively enacted agricultural property rights from the agricultural interest, and at great cost in property rights implications and economics to the agricultural interest and to our state. The precedent that such action would create would be unparalleled and have far-reaching consequences, not only for the wind industry, but for all zoning districts and industries in our state. Further, the bill does not include any form of a grandfathered-in clause, whereby those developments that have been invested in already under current law are excluded from any possible change in law at a later stage of development. If this is how Minnesota were to choose to act toward its businesses and industries, why would any potential business or industry choose to locate here? Do you choose to hang out the closed or open for business sign in Minnesota? Thank you for letting me speak. I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. We are going to have questions afterwards, so stay close. Ms. Hegedahl. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Lisa Hegedahl, and I'm a beef producer from Dodge County in southeastern Minnesota. Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for allowing me to speak before you today and to bring this my opposition to this bill before you. I run our family farm, which consists of two farms totaling 440 acres, and the land is owned by my parents. In the 23 years since I returned home to run the farm, the finances and economics have always been uncertain. Often when the crops are good, the prices are low. When cattle prices are up, the feed and forage is scarce. Most farmers cannot make a living off just farm income alone. One or both spouses work off the farm to support the family and the farm operation. Growing up, both my parents worked off the farm. Now, so do I. Also, while growing up, my father would tell me of the old days and how important the windmill was for providing water for livestock and electricity for the farm. I often pestered him to put up one of those old windmills to generate our own electricity on the farm, and his response was usually, "It's just not feasible." Today, however, it's more than feasible. It is a reality. One of the few consistencies we do have in the agricultural sector, and especially in Dodge County, is wind. I wish I had a nickel for every time I've chased my hat across the yard after the wind has blown it off my head. But even better, I want as many turbines sited on our family land as we possibly can. The bill that has been brought before this committee will virtually decimate the development of wind energy in the state of Minnesota because it further restricts the placement of turbines when sighting is already limited by such things as low wind speed, sensitive land areas, urban and residential districts, roads and waterways, just to name a few. By increasing the setback requirements, it diminishes the property rights of those landowners who do want the turbines. It also negatively impacts the rural economies at a time when this state and our local communities need all the business and economic development it can get. Wind development has a significant impact with local spending on construction, lease payments to landowners, dividends to local owner investors, property taxes paid to counties and local governments like townships, and additional local jobs in maintenance and operation once the project is up and running. I know this impact firsthand, as my off-farm job is a night manager at a local hotel. When a wind project was being developed 4 years ago, our hotel, restaurant, and bar all had substantial increases in revenue. We had teams of developers, engineers, truckers, transport escorts, contractors, cement workers, and electricians all spending money in our local businesses. Well after the turbines began to spin, we still have support teams, inspectors, tours, and others adding to our bottom line. I wholeheartedly believe in wind energy and all the good that it can do for our local communities, our state, and our nation. I am an investor in the High Country Energy community-based wind project located in Dodge, Olmsted, and Mower counties, and I serve on its farmer advisory board. My parents, who are also here today, have signed our land into that project and have also invested additional monies as their belief is as strong as mine. Many of our neighbors have also committed to the project because they know the benefits of such a project for themselves and for their communities. Those who are opposed to the wind energy development have their own property rights, but their rights should not be allowed to infringe upon our rights to use our assets to the betterment of our businesses and our families' livelihoods. They are trying to subject our agriculturally zoned land to residentially zoned restrictions. Wind energy opponents in the past have stated that they represent a majority of residents and wind project areas. They did so today as well. They like to believe that if a landowner doesn't sign with a wind project, that they are opposed to a wind energy. This is simply not true. Many landowners may not be able to sign because of the ownership is tied up in the land for the land. Some may simply not want to have to farm around the turbines. It's their property, and it's absolutely their choice. Wind opponents have often used the argument that they are the majority based on the number of people they bring to a meeting. The reality is that the wind opponents are a very vocal minority. The reason I'm able to attend this meeting today is because it is my night off at the hotel, and my farming operation doesn't require me to plant corn and soybeans. My forages are being planted in a few weeks. John made a tremendous sacrifice by leaving his field today to come here. My sacrifice was minor compared to his. The reality is that while these meetings are occurring, most farmers are working their fields, they're planting their crops, they're feeding and tending their livestock, and they're doing a host of other tasks that put food on the tables of people around this world, including those very same people who oppose the farmers' right to use their land as they deem necessary for the survival of their business, their home, and their families. In conclusion, the benefits of wind energy generation far exceed the perceived negatives that wind opponents tout. Increased economic activity to our local communities, increased tax revenues paid to our local units of government, job promotion for both general and skilled labor, reduced dependence on fossil fuels and foreign oils, and reduction in pollution all add up to overwhelming reasons to support wind energy development in this state and not to obstruct and discourage it with legislation that takes away the landowner's property rights and holds back the economic recovery of this great state.
Thank you, Ms. Hegedal.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Senator Howe, I'd like to have Director Grant come up and give his thoughts on Senate File 1069, please.
Madam Chair and members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. Just a couple of thoughts on this. I think you've found in your packets perhaps the summary of the administrative law judge's recommendation to the Public Utilities Commission and the matter that was before them regarding the Goodhue County Wind Ordinance. I think in spite of some of the remarks that's been made earlier today, that was a thorough review of the evidence both for and against imposing the ordinance and on the grounds that health issues or stray voltage issues warranted that kind of a move. I think her clear findings were that such a move was not supported by the record in front of her, which took several weeks of hearings to compile. All of you are aware, this matter, of course, also has been heard on the other side of the street. There was a bill. This bill was heard in the House Agriculture Committee. It did not go forward. However, there is strong interest in assembling a working committee on the whole wind siting issue at our direction over the interim. We welcome the opportunity to lead such an effort. We hear the concerns that have been raised by landowners in the affected areas, and we certainly want to be responsive to them. So we're more than open to such a process and to reevaluating our current standards. I think it's important to note, though, that the approach that the bill takes would take the desires of one particular Minnesota county and impose them on the rest of the state. And I think that's challenging, both in terms of the desires of those other 86 counties around the state, and also in terms of the ability to move forward in an orderly way with the development of this renewable energy resource. So we have obvious concerns with this, but we think we have an approach moving forward to address those concerns, and we look forward to working with members of this committee and all of the members of the public that are here today and not here today in moving forward on that issue.
Director Grant, do you see this working group going through the LEC or a separate working group?
Madam Chair, as I understand the language right now, the Department of Commerce would appoint the group and work with the group, but we'd be happy to bring the findings of that group to the Legislative Energy Commission and to share those with you. If there's another approach that this committee feels would be preferable, I believe that language is certainly in flux at this point. It hasn't been attached to anything in the other body.
So there's language being drafted right now?
That's correct.
You might want to stay close. I first want to thank both the proponents and the opponents for their testimony in a timely manner. That was very nice. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Senator Howe,
comments here. You know, first off, with respect to what happened in the House, I know it was a tie vote over there, but I don't think we should be prejudiced by what the other body does. We should deliberate and discuss in this body what's important. And I think had this not been an informational hearing, and it would have been a hearing, there certainly would have been an amendment to address some of the concerns that was that would have changed this, that it wouldn't have been imposing one county's will on other counties in our state. But let's just talk about that one county in Goodhue County. Obviously, there were certain concerns about several projects that were moving forward. The Planning Advisory Commission met about three times. They formed a subcommittee to draft a revised ordinance, a revised wind ordinance. They had eight meetings, including input from three major wind companies that were looking at developing wind projects in the county. Many local citizens attended these meetings. It was a highly, highly publicized event in Goodhue County. The subcommittee presented their revised recommendations to the Planning Advisory Commission, who passed the ordinance with some revision. And then the full county board of commissioners passed a wind ordinance. So this process took almost a year to complete. And it is true that the administrative law judge found that struck down their ordinance. But I do think, you know, we have land owner rights and property owner rights on both sides of the issue. And that's why I think we should give direction, and I think we should give local control. And, I'm certainly for alternative energies where they make sense. And I know a lot of people like to speak of green energy, and I certainly think a lot of people see wind energy as a green energy. Unfortunately, we don't see the devastation that happens on the other side of the earth because of this energy. We just see it in its end form. So I really think that when we look towards alternative energy, we need to see it from the start to the finish and see what environmental hazards or byproducts that are created and look at the total life cycle and see where we want to go. But I certainly think, and I certainly appreciate the committee hearing this bill, and I think there should be some reasonable accommodations made to local counties. I can't speak to whether or not the setbacks in this bill that are correct. There certainly would have been, if there would have been a hearing, some modifications to give even more local control to the counties for these wind projects. So with that, I'd entertain any questions.
Senator Harrell. I just like to make just a couple comments before we open it up. And first of all, this body and this committee is not influenced by what goes on across the street. So this is something that we wanted to do for you, Senator Howe, and give you a hearing on this. And all along, we knew that there was going to be some issues with wind siting. That's been something that we're going to have to jump into. We've had a lot on our plate, as you know. But I will disagree with you that I think what one county does send a very strong signal through the industry and with our RES going forward. So we have to be very careful. With that being said, I do believe that wind is a strong agricultural product, just as Mr. Myers said. And being the agronomist and being in a district that is very heavily renewable, along with animal crop production, you have to keep a balance here. So I believe that a lot of work needs to be done in the Senate file 1069 in the entire scope of this issue going forward. We just can't have a blanket bill like this. I believe, this is my opinion, and others have others' opinion, but I think this sends a really strong signal, and I would need to know how many turbines, if this bill went forward, how many turbines you'd have in the county. I think it would be very, very minimal by the time you meet all these setbacks and these rules. Martin County is the number one hog-producing county in the state, And we have learned with that, and it's a very strong industry, totally support it, but there is some neighbor or user-friendly rules that should be in place also, that you're not a good neighbor when you put your hog confinement in the north quarter way off of your house right next to the property of or the house of somebody else, and it's off there. So there's been this relationship that's had to develop with the animal production industry that I think needs to probably be recognized by this industry too, that you have to be neighbor friendly with your development.
With that,
I do have a question as far as how many turbines this bill would allow in Goodhue County if it was moved. Do you know, Senator Hill?
Madam Chair, I don't. And let me just clear up one indication, one miscommunication. I certainly wasn't implying to you or to this body that we are going to be influenced. I was just stating that I thought Bill Grant's comments were inappropriate to the nature of what happened over in the House. I don't believe that should be a consideration, nor even brought up in this discussion. That was my point.
Thank you, Senator Hill. And if somebody could answer, get an answer at that point, how many turbines would be in Goodhue County? I'd appreciate it. Yes, and Ms. Rosenquist, and then somebody from the proponent side, if they'd like to come up, either Mr. Grant or Mr. Meyer, Mr. Sheffers, Ms. Hagendahl, if you'd like to come up, and then we can ask some questions. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. A few questions. First, what is the setback requirement right now?
Senator Hill.
Madam Chair and Senator Brown, what the ordinance passed was a 10 rotor circumference setback from any non-participant that was found not to be in compliance. So maybe Ms. Rosenquist could explain what.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I wasn't sure. Did you mean what was the county ordinance's setback or what is the state setback?
Mr. Brown, or Senator Brown.
Well, the county ordinance was ruled, not illegal, but it was overruled. Is that correct? So I guess I'm talking about the state setback.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Rosenquist.
Senator Brown, the state setback minimum is 500 feet plus being able to meet the state's noise standards. And again, the concern that we have had with the state noise standards is they specifically do not measure low-frequency sound, which is the primary issue brought up in the Department of Health paper.
Senator Brown?
Yes, Madam Chair. That would be less than one-tenth of 1 mile. My grandpa had a windmill. We're talking about old windmills. If these structures were the size of Grandpa's windmill, we wouldn't be having these discussions today. However, I would hope that at some point in the future, whether through this committee or through an advisory group, we could come to agreement between all parties on what setback requirement would please everyone. Maybe I'm being too optimistic in my suggestion of that, but I would like hope that we could find some compromise in the area. One of the farmers, Mr. Sheffers, suggested maybe the setback should be 1,000 feet, but I guess my hope would be that we could find a mutual compromise on this.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Other questions?
You can answer that. Madam Chair?
Senator Hill.
Ms. Rosenquist would be able to answer your question.
Oh, thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't believe I have a numerical answer. I think the answer is that where wind companies find landowners who wish to participate, either there's not just one type of agreement. You can sign a lease that allows a turbine or turbines to be placed on your property. You can also sign what's called a good neighbor agreement. So there are small landholders in the Goodhue County footprint for the project that is furthest along in permitting who would not have a turbine because their property is small, but have signed what is called sometimes a good neighbor or friendly neighbor agreement, meaning they are provided some annual compensation for basically saying it's fine with me and I'm not going to complain. So I would say that the number of turbines depends on the number of people who believe that it is in their best interest as a property owner in that area who are affected who have signed up with the wind company. If they have widespread participation, either through a turbine agreement or a good neighbor agreement, then that's those areas would be open for turbines.
Mr. Meyer.
I'm on the advisory board for the wind project in our area as a farmer, landowner, looking out for not only my own interests, but my neighbors on small tracts as well. And we advocated for them. Because of that involvement, we set in place literally a 1,200-foot setback from a residence. Notice the difference in the language in this bill. This is a half mile from a non-participating property line, not from a house. You could have a section of land with a house in the corner, and the half mile starts from the backside of your farm. That takes out an awful lot of land. Now, just picture yourself as a developer coming in, wanting to build energy through wind to meet our renewable energy standard, and trying to assess a given area. You can assess the winds, but there's no way for you to know who will participate and who won't. If your setbacks from any non-participating property line are a half mile, it takes out an awful lot of land, and it makes the project completely unfeasible. I know this because of my involvement on the advisory board. I know how the projects get cited out in order to determine what's the potential here. If North Dakota and South Dakota have far less restrictive language in their law, what developer is going to come to Minnesota and even start laying the first dollar down to check out what the potential is? It just will not happen. Half mile will kill wind. Your best answer on that will come from the developers. Have them draw up a map of what the potential is for an area with the law as it stands currently, only using what they typically use as a setback. I can tell you in the Goodhue Wind Project, the state law was in place. They cited out wider than the state law ordinance. The anti-wind movement came and tried to force them to a quarter mile. They gave them 1,500 feet, which is 200 feet more. Now they're pushing for a half mile. They want to kill wind, period.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Senator Howe bringing this issue forward and for all the people testifying to give me a good start at a background on this issue. And I may be the only one in the room that's going to have this next question, Madam Chair. And if it's a long and detailed one, I will take my answer with staff or other people. But as I'm listening to this issue, I'm thinking, what is our role and what is the role of, say, the Public Utilities Commission or other people that would I think of them as setting up some of these rules. We set in the general policies that we want wind, and then I was thinking that the Public Utilities Commission or perhaps the State Department might work out some of these details. I'm happy to look at them, and I'm happy to think about them, but I'm curious where one role might start and another role fit in with that. So whose role is whose in decisions
like
this?
That's a very good question.
Yeah. And like I said, this may be really complicated, and I can maybe find answers at a later date.
We love you, Senator McGuire. That's a perfect question. And actually, if somebody from the PUC, Mr. Wolf, would like to come up and just answer some of these questions about the role of the legislature, how you determine setbacks, is that what you're asking,
yes,
Senator
thank
McGuire?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Questions like this, Manager. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Obviously, as a quasi-judicial body, we don't take positions for legislation or against legislation, but affect the policies that you provide for us. In terms of the setback and what our recent experience has been, I brought with me Ms. DeBleeker, who is with our Energy Facilities Unit and has got more experience with that. So,
Ms. Bleeker.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senators. I don't know if you want me to address Senator McGuire's question regarding...
Just state your name first for
the
record.
Oh, Tricia DeBleeker.
Mm-hmm. Don't have to take a long time to do that, but...
I guess I do see these issues blending in between policy and standards. I mean, I see the technical side versus what scientific information is out there and available, and I see that as a PUC role. However, these issues do touch on policy issues. When there isn't scientific information available, or the information doesn't support a finding of a community or something that they're advocating for, then at what point does it become a policy issue? And that's something I also struggle with. So I don't know if that fully answers your question or just adds to it. But
Sam McGuire.
I feel like I'm in good company then, Madam Chair.
Okay. But, yeah. Okay. Any questions for the POC?
Oh.
Ms. Bleeker?
I would like to clarify on the setback issue about what the state setback is. We do evaluate projects on a case-by-case basis right now, and what we're looking at is the Environmental Quality Board had set up kind of a baseline set of standards that were brought to the commission when the that department was transferred to the commission. And while 500-foot and the noise standard was what the baseline was that we used. In the past year, the commission hasn't authorized any large wind facility that has been permitted with a setback less than 1,000 feet from a non-participating residence. So this is an issue that the commission is looking at on a regular basis and something that is continually discussed. So we're not taking this lightly.
Right. So, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just to follow up on that, so if you were to change the setback, that would be something you could do without us, but we can pass laws that encourage you to set that. I mean, am I thinking of it all in the right way?
Senator, that's correct. As Mr. Bleeker said, it is looked at on a case-by-case basis, and as she said, it's 1,000 feet is typical. Some have been cited at 1,250. If there is a minimum standard that should be applied, that could be done through a number of processes. One would be, as you say, enacting legislation to establish that. The commission could do that by promulgating rules. That obviously is, with any rulemaking process, a longer-term road in which to accomplish that, but that's possible. Or the commission could do it by commission order, and we would set up a docket in which to do that and, again, gain public input.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. That does help.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
You were out there babysitting, weren't you?
What's that?
You were out there babysitting.
I was out there. Members, I did have, and folks in the audience, if you see me earlier, I did check in the back with my 6-week-old granddaughter, and I was very, very proud to parade her around the Capitol this morning.
You should have passed her around.
Yeah.
Part of this afternoon. So. I thought a grandbaby like that could always settle any conversations that get heated. So, I guess, Mr. Wolf, Ms. Bleeker, we heard somebody talk about low-frequency noise. Has anybody looked at that at the PUC, or has anybody brought some of the science in on the low-frequency noise and the potential, whether harm to humans or animals?
Ms. Bleeker.
Senator, the low-frequency noise issue is something that comes up, I think, on all dockets before the commission regarding large wind facilities. What the commission is currently doing is they require noise modeling, and now we're requesting noise monitoring of each facility. So when once a project is up and running, we're getting the data brought to the commission so we can evaluate that low-frequency noise. All the scientific information that we have looked at and evaluated has indicated that the low-frequency noise from wind turbines isn't at a level that is significant, and it's – So it's something that we are considering in each and every docket.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Bleeker. So how much monitoring or modeling do we have of this low-frequency noise currently?
Ms. Bleeker.
We have reports from different consultants and everything that have been predicting in other states that have done some monitoring and modeling. However, in this state, we are waiting for some of our first studies to come back.
Senator Jumper?
That's good for now.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and just for members' information, maybe the PUC, maybe you already know this, low-frequency noise issue came up around the airport. City of Richfield really pressed the subject. There was a fairly extensive examination and study of low-frequency noise emanating into the residential areas of Richfield, because those houses, folks who lived in those houses contended that it was moving through the ground, of course, and and it's not so much about your ears, but, how it impacts your body, and also, your china and the vibration and sort of things that are happening inside your house that you can't mitigate for through normal means like you do for other kinds of airport, more high-frequency airport noise. So it might be worthwhile to take a look at their fairly extensive scientific study.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dill, for that information. And, yes, we have looked at that that data that is available.
Good to know. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dibble? Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Everybody good? Senator Howell, thank you very much for bringing this forward. Thank you for this hearing. As you know, we're just going to lay it over. I hope to be involved in this working group, and I hope that you'll be involved with it too. And I want to thank your constituents for coming. Obviously, we have a lot of work to do in this area. And we'll continue to work, but again, thank you for the...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you
for the work
members.
You've done.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we are going to just have a very good discussion about the Conservation Improvement Program, the CIP program. And as you know, Senator Benson's done a tremendous amount of work on that. House File 1025 is... Representative Beard has been carrying a lot of legislation dealing with the CIP provisions. We want to have a real good discussion about the Conservation Improvement Program because, as you know, the House Omnibus Bill has a lot of this stuff in here, and we have not had the discussion that we should be having or the work that we need to have on the program. So with that, I thought I'd have Mr. Fuller just kind of give a brief summary about what's out there for CIP bills.
Members, Madam Chair, there are three proposals out there. They're referred to as like the co-op muni proposal, the large user proposal, and the gas proposal. As background, under current law, in the electric area, if you have a 20-megawatt load or more, you can petition to be exempt from CIP. That means you don't pay into the rates for CIP, and they don't use your revenue to figure their CIP obligation. Under current law, as of 2007, the munis and the co-ops and IOUs are subject to more or less the same general rules. So the co-op and the muni bill, and you'll find the text of most of the proposals, they propose amendments to have separate sets of rules for co-ops and munis, remove themselves from the rules that were set up in 2007 that applied to all the utilities. And that's found on the laundry list of changes is on 12.20 of this document that's in your packet. I won't go into them. I assume they're going to testify to them. They are different than the rules that currently apply to them. Their obligations are changed. There's other changes, but that's the guts of the muni proposal. Then there's the gas proposal. Gas proposal sets up two separate exceptions for the CIP program. One is based on the size of the customer use of gas, half a billion decatherms. And another exception, which can be utilized by petition, is for large commercial use or for commercial users who can disconnect from the utility and hook up to the pipeline. And if they do that, then the cost for the remaining ratepayers for the fixed cost would go up. So that's a concern. My understanding is there's an agreement in principle on the large gas exemption. And it's a little bit different than what's in the House bill, and maybe people will talk to that. So there's the co-op one, which the co-op muni proposal, which sets up different rules for the co-ops and munis and for the investor-owned utilities. There's a large gas user one. And the large gas user component that deals with users who can hook up and they can exempt, that only applies in the House bill to customers, utilities who have less than 300,000 customers, meaning it exempts NSP and CenterPoint. But my understanding is there are discussions to bring CenterPoint in so that only the customers, or to bring NSP in, so that only the customers of CenterPoint would have that, they would not have that ability to petition because they have the right to or the ability to disconnect. So then the third one is the large energy user bill. As I said, under current law, if you're a large energy user, which is defined in law, you can petition to be removed from the law. Again, your rates won't include the cost of the SIP program with respect to you, and the utility won't do any SIP work for you, and their obligation doesn't include the electricity they sell to you. As the proposal came in, that threshold for qualifying was reduced from 20 to 10 megawatts, and there were other changes. It went from the facility to the customer itself. They could aggregate different facilities. That's gone. And the only change you'll see is on 9.28 of this document. The proposal would be to include, with the ability to be exempted, include demand offset by on-site cogeneration facility, and if engaged in mineral extraction, aggregate peak energy demand from the customer's mining and processing facilities. And then there's another component of this, which is less regulatory hurdles to go through to get your exemption. Under current law, there's a filing and a determination by the commissioner and a revisit on a periodic basis. Under this proposal, there'd be filing, basically, did you file right? You get it, and you never revisit it. And with the gas, and they've been integrated in the House bill, so that would apply to the gas as well. In the separate gas proposal, they just piggyback on the current law. They do not change the regulatory regime. They just set up some new classifications of use of customers who can are not covered by SIP. So those are the three components. Co-op and Muni proposing a new set of obligations under SIP, whereas they're now the same with the IOU. The large users slightly expanding the class of large users who can be exempt, but lessening the regulatory oversight of it. And the large gas users, two components, one large, the other one ability to disconnect, excluding customers from CenterPoint and NSP now, but discussions that NSP will be part of that mix as well. So those are the three proposals. They're blended together. In the Senate, there's three separate bills. And there was in the House as well, and they blended them together.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. I could have said that. Probably not. You say it much, much better, trust me. So we have approximately an hour, and we have quite a few testifiers. And I think if we keep it to about 5 minutes each, we should be okay with some questions. If there's a particular testifier that comes up, we can ask them questions at that time if y'all promise to keep it short and brief and to the point. But let's get clarified about our SIP program for going forward. And Senator Benson, do you have any comments that you'd like to make? Or?
Well, I'm ready to look at the House language and hear their comments. Any questions that come forward so I can take them with me.
Great. Thank you. First on the docket is Mr. Walters, Regulatory Legislative Affairs Manager for Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Walters, and I work with Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation, or we'll call it MERC to save on time here.
That'd be nice. Thank you.
I'm speaking on behalf of Senate File 1349, and this is the one Mr. Fuller talked about the large gas users and the ability for them to be able to apply for and petition the commission for exemption from the SIP charges. Back when this was originally done, we've provided you a kind of a one-page summary of the issues and hopefully a solution to it. But back in the day when this was originally done, the only thing that was looked at was just electrical usage. Large natural gas users were never identified in the exemption language. Since then, there's been changes to the SIP legislation, the 2007 energy bill, certainly increased our costs. In it, I point out the fact that back in 2005, our utility, MERC, was owned by a different company at the time, Aquila, but at that point, our total SIP costs for our program was $1.1 million. Next year, we're projecting that it'll be $9.9 million. So in a matter of 7 years, we've gone up nine times. So the costs have gone up considerably, especially for our large customers. It has increased the incentive for them to leave the system to bypass the local utility and be able to go directly to the pipeline. If they do that, then they all of a sudden become a pipeline operator, and they also don't have to pay any SIP costs. And obviously, there's a loss of revenue to the utility, and whatever those costs of loss there are going to get spread back to the other ratepayers as well. So those are significant costs. To give you an idea of what this charge is, how they look to the average large customer, and what we're talking about here are customers that use a half a BCF of gas on an annual basis. And just to kind of put this in perspective, that's 500,000 decatherm. And the average residential home on our system uses 90 decatherms a year. So these are large customers. It's estimated between CenterPoint, Xcel, and Merck, we have approximately over 1.5 million customers, and this would affect 35. So it's not a large number of customers that we're looking at, but these are significant costs to those customers. The charge that we just had to file an adjustment for our SIP costs and for 2010, that'll go into effect in 2011 after it's approved by the commission. And this is just a true-up of expenses versus revenues that we've brought in through the charge last year. For some of our customers, for the large customers, they pay us a distribution fee to get the gas from point A to point B to them. And this is about 25% of their total bill. The SIP charge alone is greater than what the distribution cost is for our large customers under the rate that they're on. For some of these flex customers that have the ability to bypass and go directly to an interstate pipeline, they may not qualify under the half a BCF of gas usage, but because of their proximity, they can bypass the utility much easier. It's at a lower cost to them because of their proximity. Some of those customers, it's going to be seven times greater, the SIP charge, almost seven times greater than what they're paying us to get the gas to them, our distribution charge. So these charges are significant to the group, to these customers. Again, we certainly are not trying to not promote energy efficiency, but these are customers who use a tremendous amount of energy. They have all the incentive in the world to be conserving, which they do in order to stay competitive. I'd like to point out, as Mr. Fuller said, there's kind of three bills here that you're going to be hearing about. We have had discussion with the department, with Mr. Grant, and the department does support our bill. So I think that's important that we want to be sure that the committee knows. And with that, in the interest of time, there's a one page that we've handed out for you, and certainly we'll take any questions.
Mr. Walters, there was some discussion about the flex rate customer. Too. Could you please give a little background on that?
Yeah, certainly.
Thank
you,
Madam
Chair. Yeah, flex rate is basically a customer that does not qualify under the half BCF usage, but because they are located within a close proximity to an interstate pipeline, they have it's much more feasible for them. There is in statute specific language that identifies what these flex rate customers are. And basically, when we say a flex rate, there's a minimum and a maximum rate that you can charge these customers. And the utility has the ability to adjust that within that parameters for those customers in order to keep them from bypassing the system. You have to, at a minimum, recover your costs. That the statute is clear on that. But it does give the utilities the opportunity to adjust these rates for those customers, again, that are in close proximity. Again, for our utility, we're probably talking about a half dozen customers that that are on a flex rate. So it's not a large number, but again, they are fairly large users.
So, Mr. Walters, would the department do that, or would the PUC do that?
The commission would do it. This, in both cases, whether you use the half a BCF, or if you're a flex rate customer and prove you're a flex rate customer, it still has to go before the commission. The commission has to review it, and there is criteria that's talked about in the bill. They have to show that they're taking steps to conserve, that there's competitive reasons. So there is a list of criteria that the Public Utility Commission will use as part of their review process when these customers petition the commission for exemption. And again, we're not asking for a forever exemption. We're basically mirroring what currently is occurring, that every 5 years the customer has to reapply for certification of exemption.
I would assume, Mr. Walters, you're fine with that criteria. That
yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm wondering. Any questions for Mr. Walters? It's like a good provision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walters. Mr. Cruz from the Mayo Clinic, please. Hello, Mr. Cruz. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Mark Cruz. I'm a section head of utility operations for the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Although one might not expect to find a Mayo Clinic representative in front of a Senate Energy Committee.
Oh, no, we had Senator Senjum for years.
In that case. But being a large user of natural gas and electricity, the SIP exemption for large users of natural gas is legislation that Mayo Clinic supports. At Mayo Clinic, we serve almost 2 million customers every year. Providing care for these patients requires a large amount of energy in order to support the patient care environment and equipment required to meet Mayo's mission of providing the best patient care every day. Mayo Clinic places a great emphasis on controlling costs and being efficient so that our physicians and nursing staff can tend to what matters most in our practice, the care of the patient. As such, we are driven to minimize our energy use and are committed to being good environmental stewards. In support of this ongoing effort, Mayo Clinic has spent millions of dollars over the past years in energy conservation efforts, including installation of a 150-kilowatt solar panel, upgrades of lighting, lighting controls, kitchen exhaust hoods, building automation controls, and power plant equipment controls. In continuation of these efforts, Mayo Clinic has developed two energy coordinator positions along with a green committee to review and sustain our energy improvement efforts. These people are charged with monitoring Mayo's energy consumption, identifying areas of improvement, developing and evaluating energy reduction projects, and creating new energy standards that we can implement into both new and remodeled facilities. Not only does cost and payback factor into these decisions, but things such as technology, reliability, environmental concerns all factor in order to make the best decision and create the best value. Mayo Clinic's energy management efforts continue to grow. To date, we have obtained energy savings of over $250,000 per year. However, the exciting part is not just the reduction of energy, it's seeing a development of a culture within our doors in which our staff are aware of their energy usage and are taking steps individually to minimize that. Unfortunately, many of the efforts I've just stated, given either their uniqueness or for some other reason, has not met the specific qualifications to be eligible for rebates underneath the SIP program. Based off our past several months' invoices, Mayo Clinic anticipates paying between $400,000 and $430,000 a year in conservation cost recovery contributions based off its natural gas usage alone. Of this amount, approximately $15,000 to $20,000 a year is returned in the form of any type of energy rebate. Based off this information, One could argue that a SIP exemption would promote additional conservation at Mayo Clinic, as funds currently being paid out under SIP could instead be used on conservation efforts within our institution. Continually, these funds would lower our energy costs and in turn focus more dollars on providing the best care to our patients. On behalf of Mayo Clinic, I ask for your support to include exemption return reform measures in the Conservation Improvement Act, specifically as it relates to natural gas usage, as well as any reforms to streamline or simplify the current exemption process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Any questions for Mr. Cruz? Mr. Cruz, I'm just thinking of the Mayo Clinic and other large hospitals, medical centers like that. They're all facing the same thing. Do you know? And do you share information once in a while?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any other or have that information of other hospitals or clinics in our vicinity.
Is it because you're a research facility, too? And
Madam Chair, a large part of it is just the volume of our patients. We are one of the largest privately owned hospitals in the state and in the country.
How many patients do you have per year?
We're close to 2 million patients per year come through our doors.
Oh, that's something. Better have good record keeping. Great. Thank you, Mr. Cruz.
Thank you.
And Mr. Lee. Welcome, Mr. Lee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Lee. I am an attorney here in Minneapolis, and for the last 40 years I've been practicing energy law. And our clientele is comprised of these super large energy customers you heard about earlier from Mr. Fuller. These are customers whose typically their electric bill runs perhaps $1 million a week for electricity, several hundred thousand dollars a week for natural gas. The only kind of entities in Minnesota that fall into that category are the taconite mines in northern Minnesota, paper mills scattered around the state, and an oil refinery or two. The reason that these entities are such huge energy users is that they're engaged in a business where a very large portion of the total cost of the product is energy. And in typical case, we're talking between 25 and 35% of the cost of the final product is either electric energy or gas energy or both. Many years ago now, the legislature in its wisdom decided that it was not necessary to require these kinds of customers to engage in energy conservation because the marketplace compels them to do that. If they want to stay in business, they've got to invest in conservation, and they have been doing so. However, when that statute was first amended to include those exemptions, the legislature basically decided that it should be a limited-term exemption and that these companies should be required to come back every 5 years and prove up that, in fact, that they were doing conservation measures. I believe that we are now on the third cycle of that. In that time, no company's exemption has been removed. These companies have proved over and over and over again that they are spending prodigious amounts of money on energy conservation. Of the 10 companies for whom I filed reports, I believe in the last five-year cycle, it showed that we spent approximately $200 million on energy conservation projects in the state of Minnesota. We aren't quite finished filing reports in this cycle, but so far we're in the 140 145 to 150 million range, and I think we have two more companies to report for. So these these companies are spending a lot. They don't need to be regulated in this standpoint, and it strikes us that continuing to have these 5-year renewal periods is an enormous waste of the resources, both of the department, the Office of Energy Security, and of our own people. Preparing these reports takes a huge amount of time of the very people that we are looking to find energy conservation projects for us and engineer them. We've long, long since gone past the point of having simple projects where you put in a more efficient light or a more efficient motor. In today's world, in order to save power or save gas, we need to change the process. And that requires a large degree of engineering capability, and we'd like to have those people doing that, not filing reports with the department. That's the one topic that I wanted to talk about today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions about other Thank points you. In the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Any questions for Mr. Lee? Dibble.
He likes it.
I'm sure I'm in a learning mode.
Right okay. Now. All right. Thank you. You're a good student. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
You're welcome.
Next, Mr. Scott Blumhofer. Our Mr. Peter Larson. And maybe Mr. Zern.
Yes.
Okay, we got it. You guys are with it.
She's here today.
Welcome, you three. Please state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm here for the Minnesota Biofuels Association, and my job here before these gentlemen speak about their facilities is just to show you something that we gave you. Some of you are very familiar with the ethanol industry, others not as much. And so in order to give you a context for what these folks are talking about, I just wanted to show you this. You have this document that shows you where the ethanol facilities are in the state and how many there are. You can go to the next page and see the number of facilities and how it's grown over the years. And then particularly I wanted to have you pay attention to the bottom graph, which shows not only the increases in production, but the relative increase in production as it relates to our consumption. And you can see the significant export that this industry does out of Minnesota and brings money back into Minnesota. So that was just a little bit of context for those of you. I know some of you are very familiar with the industry, but I thought that might give you an idea of who these gentlemen are speaking for today. I'd be happy to answer questions about the industry, but we have two folks here to talk about their facilities.
You know, Mr. Larson, that almost half the ethanol produced is produced in my Senate district.
Oh.
Pretty impressive.
Wow.
And all in hogs.
Yeah, that and hogs and wind. We love wind, too.
So, how much corn is she going to take?
Great district. Unfortunately, I'm losing it. I like my district. Mr. Blumhofer or Mr. Zern?
I'm Scott Blumhofer with Heartland Corn Products.
Welcome, Mr. Blumhofer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. Heartland Corn Products is a 100 million gallon per year ethanol plant located in Winthrop, Minnesota. We've been in operation since 1995, and we're a cooperative owned by 950 local farmers. As the ethanol industry continues to look for ways to bring value back to our communities, there remains a focus on efforts to continually improve our efficiencies and our crush margins. Crush margins are essentially what we receive for the products we sell, less all the expenses to operate the facility. Behind the cost of corn, energy is the second highest expense that factors into that crush margin. Due to the impact of that cost of energy, both as electricity and fuel, such as natural gas, ethanol facilities have a history of reducing our energy usage. Andy Zern will speak to more specific efforts made by the industry and their impacts, but economic return, meaning improved crush margins and more dollars out to our communities, drive an initiative for all ethanol plants to address their energy usage. Over the past 15 years, the industry has reduced its fuel use by about 15% and its electrical use by over 20% and in some cases over 30%. The nature of our business dictates that we have to continue to look for ways to improve efficiencies, driven by economic reasons, not programs. Most ethanol plants in the state of Minnesota are of two sizes, about 50 million gallons per year of production and about 100 million gallons per year in production, some a bit smaller and some a bit larger. But under the current conservation improvement program, a typical 50 million gallon per year plant spends over $280,000 per year in SIP expenses, and a 100 million gallon per year plant spends over $600,000. In either case, these costs represent a half a cent per gallon expense in an industry where net income may not be much more than 10 cents per gallon. This significant cost affects the competitiveness of this industry in Minnesota and ultimately reduces the positive impacts that we can have on our communities. I believe you have a handout that has Guardian Energy on the top. Did we get the handout? Okay. On the back side, where it says typical ethanol facility conservation improvement program costs and energy efficiency, you could flip to the back side. About halfway down, you can see where it references that an average CIP per 10 million gallons of production per year is about $55,000. In context, just below that, you can see that a typical production worker's salary and benefits at an ethanol facility is $52,000. So for every 10 million gallons of production, it costs the same amount for that facility as a typical worker. Another example is the CIP cost for a typical corn farmer that would farm 1,000 acres and bring that corn to an ethanol facility. It's costing that farmer almost $3,000 a year, or $2,999. So these are significant costs. I guess I would like to end that the ethanol industry is really a pretty simple industry and business. We have very little to say about what we get for the products we make and the products we sell. So what we need to do is focus on expenses and expenses and expenses as much as we can. And energy is the second largest expense that we have as a facility. So with that being such an important part of our business, we are really forced to find more and more ways to become efficient and reduce costs, not driven by a program, but driven by economics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blumhofer. Mr. Zirn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Zirn, and I work for Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company in Benson, Minnesota, Swift County. And we are a 48 million gallon per year plant, a similar size to Scott's. We're a co-op. We have 970 owners, most of them local farmers. We have 52 employees, so we're a relatively small company. I'm the engineering manager, and I'm usually in charge of most all the projects. So I hope to provide a little bit of the engineer's angle or the plant engineering perspective. The proposed threshold for CIP exemption, we're a large gas user, is 0.5 BCF. Our plant uses a little over 1. So we would be qualified for exemption with the new threshold, and we are in favor of that. What that means is most all the ethanol plants in Minnesota would qualify for exemption from CIP at a half a BCF. I and my coworkers, we are fixated on reducing energy use. Better efficiency improves our competitiveness, and it helps us survive during lower negative margin times. We use equipment, but more so, really, we use new yeast technologies, new enzyme technologies, and changes in how we run our operation so that we can try to get as much from every kernel of corn that we can and do it with the least amount of energy possible. Most improvement comes from subtle operating changes. Equipment tweaks, so just changes to equipment, not necessarily new equipment. New enzymes, using new enzymes and new yeast. And these kinds of changes give us fractions of our percentage in yield improvement or energy reduction. And these kinds of incremental changes are really hard to measure, and consequently, they typically fall outside the realm of CIP and don't qualify. Furthermore, they typically have really short payoff because they're, you know, there's not a lot of investment made. So that also pulls you outside of CIP. Some of you may be familiar with our gas fire project at Chippewa Valley. Several years ago, we did a multi-million dollar biomass gas fire project installation, and our intention there was to use biomass to provide heat energy for ethanol plant instead of natural gas. Using biomass to replace natural gas does not improve plant efficiency. It's simply a displacement mechanism, and therefore it does not qualify for CIP. Currently, we have a $3 million energy recovery project going on that will reduce our gas use by 10%. We're very excited by that. Prior to this effort, our last CIP payment, or our last CIP project, was 6 years ago. Cost-effective projects that qualify for CIP are becoming rare at best, which means we'll be getting little, if any, of our CIP payments returned going forward. So all the money that's going in, really, we're not recapturing any of that. And just to restate, where Scott went on 10 cents a gallon is an excellent profit for us. We're paying about a half a cent a gallon in CIP, 5% impact on our profit. And I am a shareholder and a member of the co-op. And, you know, if I could see a 5% improvement in our profits, that would be lovely.
Yeah, it seems to be that you're very limited on where you can find energy savings. I know that several of my ethanol plants have done some real cost savings, and in the past, it seemed like if there was a new technology or intervention to save energy, it was like kept a secret. But now that the industry is sharing and being much more generous with information, and it would be interesting to see what doesn't qualify on a spreadsheet or on a list for these biofuel plants. And what you've been doing, and that's not qualifying. I mean, you just ripped off a few things, Mr. Zern, and I'm a little surprised that those don't qualify. Yeah. Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, there is another piece of information to your point on this Guardian Energy document, and you can see at the bottom, this is an industry number, but the real measure of the energy efficiency of these facilities is BTUs in versus BTUs out. And you can see that from 2001 to 2008, there was a 17% improvement in that. So there couldn't be a better measure for whether these folks are really working hard on the energy efficiency side, just on a BTUs in versus BTUs out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the industry definitely has changed, absolutely. Any questions for Mr. Zern, Mr. Larson, Mr. Blumhofer? Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Meerman.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Merman. I'm the plant engineer with the Rock Tent Company here in St. Paul. And I appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to talk about our current concerns related to SIP and support the reform as it's currently being proposed. Rock Tent Company is the largest recycler of waste paper in the state. We recycle a little over 1,000 tons a day of waste paper into paperboard used in consumer packaging goods. So when you see a Wheaties box or a corrugated box that it comes in, we probably had a hand in making that. We've been in our current location since 1907, so we've been around a long time. And we currently employ 429 employees, many of which are union. The average union benefit, including benefits, is currently $71,000. The total payroll in St. Paul exceeds $25 million. So The manufacturing of recycled paper, as you've heard earlier, it requires a significant amount of energy. Although it takes about half as much energy to make recycled paper as it does comparable products from trees. Annually, we will consume about 2.2 million decatherms of fuel, which is approximately it's a little more than four times what's currently being proposed in the bill. We also will consume about 172 million megawatt hours of power. The annual cost of energy to Rock 10 this year is projected to be approximately $18 million. And due to the cost impact of energy consumption, it's a big focus for us, as it is for all large users. As a large user, we spend very heavily on capital for energy conservation. In the last 4 years, we have spent $2.2 million, and this year we are budgeting another $600,000 for energy conservation projects. We participated very heavily in the SIP program to the maximum that we currently can. However, we never fully recover what we pay in, it never has had an impact on the economics of getting a project approved. So the current statute recognizes large users as it relates to electrical usage, and it gives them an opt-out. The opt-out only applies, though, if you use over 20 megawatts of power. The statute falls short of recognizing large users of natural gas or users that co-generate power. Our current process base load is about 22 megawatts of power. We generate between 8 and 10 megawatts of power. So that's 8 to 10 megawatts of power that is not being put onto the local utility. SIP rider rates fluctuate quite a bit depending on program activity. These fluctuations have a significant impact on the users. The impact to Rock 10 of the most recent increases will result in an annual increase on the gas SIP of over $700,000. We will pay an additional probably $250,000 into the electrical SIP program. This increase is sudden, and we didn't budget for it, and it created a significant financial burden for Rock 10. This was, in fact, the single largest unbudgeted cost liability that we will see this year. Because of the markets for our end products are commodity-based, these costs cannot be passed on and must be absorbed. And absorbing these costs has resulted in cost reduction initiatives, which have included labor and jobs. The SIP program itself is a well-intended program designed to drive conservation initiatives. I myself received some incentives for putting in a new furnace this year. For the most part, it does work well for the small users. The large users, the program does not drive energy conservation because the users are already highly incentivized to conserve to ensure business viability. The program has never played a role in justifying energy conservation as its incentives are minimal relative to the most project economics. As a result, the program has become a cost and resource burden that adds to many of the liabilities that impact business viability. Just before I came down here, I met with our Excel rep, and we talked about what we have for current projects in SIP, and we spent a fair amount of time talking about the projects that we currently have on the books as well as what we have moving forward. He not only talked to myself, but two of the engineers that work for me, and took up a fair amount of time. And in my mind, the resources that were spent discussing SIP were only done so that we can recover some of the costs that we will put in, and really had no impact on driving energy conservation in our mill. We are highly incentivized to conserve as it is, and it's a requirement for business viability. We do not depend on SIP, and we see it as a burden to our business. So,
thank you, Mr. Merman. That was very well stated. Yeah, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, thank you for your comments. Do So if you are already doing a lot of these things because it's good for business to do some of these conservation improvements, is it what would be the burden? Can you just explain to me another, you know, a little bit more about what the burden is? Because if you're already sort of doing them.
Well, this year.
Mr. Merman.
Yeah.
This year we will spend, you know, like I said, $700,000 in gas and about another $250,000 in electricity. I mean, those are the costs that we pay in our utility bills. Okay, we have to work to get that money back. Okay, we spend, a lot of time and a lot of resources to get it back. If we get 10 to 15% of that back, we're doing good. But it is a significant cost burden to us, and it's a burden on the resources. My engineers and myself, there's a lot of other things that we can do to be working and making our business more viable than trying to get money back that we've already paid into a program.
Thank you, Mitch. I'm needing to get a little primer on what SIP is, so I'll ask that question another time. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Merriman?
I'm sure I'll take care of
it. He'll take care of it.
I'm sure you will.
I won't burden everybody in this room with that. So.
That wouldn't be lopsided. No.
My caucus, my caucus members are saying, give her. Ask those questions.
Mr. Merriman, any questions? Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
No. Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You bet. Oh, Senator Junkbaugh, hold on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't even know it's a question so much as I think you put it to us exactly the way we need to hear it, and I wrote it down, and I think it's a quote, that large users are already highly incentivized to be conservative, and it's required for business viability. And I think that's one thing that was missing when we originally talked about some of the SIP things is if you're spending that much on energy, anytime somebody can come up with an idea that's going to save you money, well, heck yeah, that's a good deal, and you're going to be constantly looking for those to be able to be a player in the market. Otherwise, you go out of business.
Right.
And we forget that sometimes. And so we get a lot of testifiers, and what we need, you know, sorry, but as legislators, we need bullet points, something we can grab onto that really sets it in place, I think, when we look at things. So we hear way too much every day, and so I thank you very much because you had some of your quotes were just right on in ways that I think we could digest them.
Thank you, Senator Junkbaugh. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I agree we need little simple ideas than we do.
I keep telling
you really well.
my CA, bullet points.
But one thing we also need to hold in our heads is that SIP is much about benefit to individual customers as it is about benefit to the overall system in which everybody participates and benefits. I think Xcel has estimated that they've foregone, you know, building like 8 new coal plants since they've started down this path, you know, a number of years ago. Those are 8 coal plants that we pay for directly, you know, those in the Xcel service territory would have paid for otherwise. Pretty expensive infrastructure that we've managed to avoid. That's a benefit that we can attribute fairly directly, you know, to the bottom line, whether we're individual residential small users or I mean, and I'm sympathetic to the large user argument. Don't get me wrong. I'm not opposed to what's being said here and think we need to grapple with how much large users are paying relative to their direct benefit. Absolutely. And I'm glad that this testimony is being brought forward. But we need to keep both ideas in mind. There's a larger system issue, and there's an individual.
I was wondering when you were going to break. I was wondering. I was going to put a bet on you. I just kept looking at you, Senator Junkbaugh.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And back to Senator Dibble. I think especially when it relates to recycling of paper, coming out with different products, ethanol you know, anything, and I think people have misunderstood my ethanol thought sometimes, but, you know, when ethanol first started with corn, it was very inefficient, and until you get up and running and produce more and more, that's how the efficiencies come into play, and whether it is just recycling or ethanol or some other alternative energy or some way to reuse products, those especially we ought to be sensitive to in, you know, their cost savings and getting that up to scale in the market so that we do take another sector like I guess I'll just focus on recycling. If we can reuse products of any kind, those are the kind of things we really want to encourage, and so that's what this program is kind of about, is conservation, but that's another form of conservation, so we ought to have something else in terms of really benefiting that to be a market scale-up if we're going to get, I guess, this world to be a better place all the time for everyone. So.
Thank you, Senator Jomer. Thank you, Mr. Merman.
Thank you.
Mr. Brandt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries. Our members are paper mills, sawmills, engineered wood products manufacturers, producers of forest-based renewable bioenergy, and forest landowners. And I've got my bullet point, but I'll yeah. to leave you with. But I'll say a couple of things before I get to it. We're the fourth largest manufacturing industry in the state. About a $10.4 billion product value, 40,000 jobs, $715 million in state and local tax revenues that are generated. We're about 15% of Minnesota Power's total load. As Mr. Lee said, energy costs in our industry are 25% or more of the cost of production. In fact, for producing paper, energy is a larger cost area than purchased wood. So we spend more on energy than we spend on wood to make the paper. Most of my members are already exempt. Mr. Lee spoke to that, but it's such a big issue that energy usage and energy conservation is one of the factors in calculating gain sharing in some of the union contracts with our employees. So conserving energy goes right to the individual's bottom line. It's also part of the compensation calculations for the management teams at the mills. So it's a huge issue for the competitive position. It's a huge issue actually for the individuals working in the mills. Spending time on, and we would like to see the exemptions made permanent, spending time of the engineers to do the paperwork, do the tracking, do the filings, instead of having them spending their time figuring out ways to improve our energy efficiency is not productive. So my bullet point is, here at the end of the day, to free us from the paperwork permanently, please.
Mr. Brandt, when did the forest industry become exempt? What year was that?
Most of them, Madam Chair, most of them filed immediately. I mean, we're such large users. I don't have exactly when each individual facility filed and became exempt, but I think they did it all at the same time as it was when it was first available, and that was 10 years ago. I'm trying to think, Council, when that first became an option, something like that.
Okay. Good enough. And so then every 5 years they need to.
Correct.
How much does it cost to do a filing?
You know, Madam Chair, I contacted a number of my members and asked them how much time their staffs spend on an annual basis tracking SIP-related information for filing the exemptions. Their engineering staffs each will be spending hundreds of hours on an annual basis, you know, a couple of hundred hours. To do the trackings and then to prepare for the 5-year filings, and there's more time involved then. So, you know, we're talking part of an FTE on an annual basis that we just think could be better spent working on actual energy conservation projects.
So for the department, it would be good to get an answer on the other side of why to keep the 5-year regulation. You just need to hear both sides. Mr. Brandt. Any questions for Mr. Brandt? Okay. Thank you.
Yes, did we Senator miss McGuire. Your bullet point? Did I already yeah. miss your bullet
point? Madam Chair, Senator McGuire.
I was ready for it.
Release that.
Free us from the paperwork permanently.
Okay. Oh, funny. Paper. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Senator McGuire.
thank you, Madam Chair. We do think in things other than bullet points, but bullet points do help us focus our thoughts. Thank
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'm Joel Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Our association made up of the 44 distribution co-ops in Minnesota, the six generation and transmission co-ops that provide them energy. And, excuse me, we do appreciate the chance to talk about what we've proposed in the House. I think most of you are aware that of all of the changes to the state's energy policy over the past decade, the changes to the Conservation Improvement Program has been of particular heartburn and consternation for the local distribution co-ops. And I think the main reason for that is because it really is one-size-fits-all legislation that really doesn't fit cooperatives. I think when we've visited with you in the past and when local co-op members and directors come up to visit legislators, I think one of the key things that they try to stress again and again is that we are different. We have a different business model. We're nonprofit, locally owned by our consumers. We're democratically governed. We have very different load profiles. We have different levels of density on our lines. We have a different history and approach to conservation. And I think more than anything, we have a different customer mix. And I think in your packets, you were given a chart that demonstrates clearly how different the mixes are between co-op customers and IOUs and municipals when it comes to commercial, industrial, and residential sales. As in a response to those differences, we made a number of proposals in House File 1025. As we go, and the effort on that was to make the program work better for our members. As we go through the proposal list, they essentially fall into two categories. Most of them are simply tools that will help us meet the goal easier and less expensively. And then the big one, which is a reduction in the overall goal, reflects the important difference between cooperatives and other types of utilities, and that would do the most to make the program work for our members and is our top priority. I'll kind of go through the legislation right now and tell you essentially what we're trying to do with each piece. And our measures start on page 12, line 20. And from there to line 24, essentially what this does is set a cap on spending. When the program changed over in 2007 from a spending-based goal to a savings-based goal, electric cooperatives across the state saw costs for the program increase pretty significantly. And in some cases, the costs have nearly doubled. The cost of SIP programs varies greatly between co-ops and the type of program that you're doing. But overall, average costs for the state electric co-ops, based on the 2009 OES filings, average about 20 cents per kilowatt saved. And they can run as high as 96 cents per kilowatt saved. And the original idea behind this provision was to put a cap on the spending increases. Now, through the stakeholder process led by Senator Benson and spearheaded over in this body, it's become clear that there's probably a better approach of addressing this problem is to, instead of putting a cap on spending, is simply lowering the goal for cooperatives and municipals down to 1%. We're currently working on language for an amendment in the House, and that will be added hopefully in the Ways and Means Committee soon, and that will be reflected in what the bill looks like when it heads to the House floor. And again, I'll just point again to this chart that shows the difference between the customer mix. And what we're really saying with this is for the utilities with the customer mix in the middle, that allows them to be, as one proponent of SIP recently put it, conservation superstars. Whereas if you have a customer mix like the one on the left of cooperatives, it makes it much more difficult and more expensive. And in the end, we think that 1.5 goal is really going to be unrealistic in years to come. Moving on to the next one from lines 12.25 to 12.7. This essentially ties SIP to what's going on in the economy. When the SIP legislation was written, I think pretty much everybody involved expected demand for electricity to continue to grow at a steady pace for the next, decade, 20 years. However, after the economy collapsed in late 2007, demand for electricity also cratered. Since 2007, most electric cooperatives in the state have experienced significant drops in overall load. And over 3 years later, most cooperatives are still below the 2007 levels for demand. Under current law, these cooperatives are still required to spend millions of dollars more to further reduce their sales and revenue, even as fixed costs have increased. And this is creating a significant belt tightening at the local distribution co-ops, and it's adding constraints to hiring there. By tying SIP to what's actually going on in the economy and reducing the SIP goal during times of negative load growth, we think that it will allow co-ops to make better use of their members' resources and to protect co-op jobs in economic downturns. Going on to the next section, 12.28 through 12.32, these don't really reflect any change in SIP. This is what's already in current law. This was added to this section because we moved the sections in the statute that determine how we operate under SIP. Next, from 12.33 to 13.2, what this language essentially does is lift the cap, the current cap on the amount of system savings that are allowed under the SIP goal. Currently, only 0.5% of savings can come from the system side of the meter. And then only after 1%, after the 1% goal is met on the consumer side of the meter. We believe a kilowatt hour saved is a kilowatt hour saved, and it shouldn't matter where those savings are achieved. We also think by eliminating the system-wide cap, you're going to end up with more efficient SIP programs and greater overall savings for all of our members and not just those that are participating in the various incentives and rebate programs. Moving on to 13.3 through 13.7, this essentially establishes a credit for education spending. One of the goals of the original SIP legislation was to change consumer behavior and make them conserve energy on their own. But there's no way we're going to be able to meet the SIP goals and these very aggressive goals without significant behavior modification and education, particularly when it comes to residential customers. However, right now, investments in education and training don't count on the savings side. SIP should recognize that a lot of the savings that we're seeing, throughout the state are created through education and training of consumers. The figure that we have in the language is based on the average cost of KW savings for cooperatives in 2009. Since it was 20 cents per kilowatt saved, that equals 5 kilowatt credits for every $1. Moving on to lines 13.8 through 13.29. Again, this addresses the concerns that large customers have with SIP, but it kind of looks at it from a different perspective. Over the past decade, we've had a number of smaller cooperatives, including a couple in your district, Madam Chair, who have had new ethanol plants come online, and suddenly overnight their load on their system increases by up to 25%. And, while we welcome those, and that's great for the local economy, it does prevent some real challenges for SIP. For the most part, these plants have been state-of-the-art, and the co-ops have worked with during construction to make sure that, they're including the latest technology on conservation. And, you know, the result has been is that increasing conservation at many of these plants is next to impossible. However, because they've added 25% load overnight, it also means that the SIP goal for that co-op is increased overnight by 25% as well. And this language attempts to address at least some of that, at least the newer ones that have come on in the last 4 or 5 years. Moving on to lines 13.30 through 14.2. Again, this was just added again to make sure that current laws is still applicable to co-ops and municipals. Lines 14.9 through 14.13. This is the counting. Essentially what this does is allow the counting of load management that shifts load away from peak periods as conservation. You know, one of the chief arguments for SIP is that it delays the need for the construction of new generation, and that's where a lot of the savings come from. However, at least for cooperatives, the real driver for new generation is increases in demands at peak periods of the day. I've provided another chart in here that shows the wind output compared to load. The black line, squiggly line, you see here is the typical daily load for a cooperative in the state. And, you know, as you can see later in the day, essentially from around 5 to about 11 o'clock at night is where load really increases. And over the years, co-ops have found that the best way to avoid constructing new baseload generation is to shift demand away from that peak period of time, oftentimes shifting it from then into lower periods of type like the overnight hours where demand really goes down. The ways that we've done that is through on and off cycling of air conditioning, heating programs, and other home appliances, off-peak water heating, off-peak grain drying irrigation, backup generation of large loads, among other things. Under current law, we can only count that the kilowatt hours that are actually saved through those projects. We believe there's value in counting the kilowatts that are also shifted. And one other thing that we think that this would accomplish is, as I think we've talked with most of you about, one of the challenges that co-ops are having with integrating all of these new wind resources into our portfolios is that a lot of times we're getting too much wind at times that we don't need it in these overnight hours. And I think if you look at the chart, you can kind of see when the wind is often blowing when the demand is at its lowest. And what this change would do was would create kind of a new market and increase demand during those off-peak hours and make better use of our wind resources, which are growing, you know, year by year. Under the lines 14.24 through 15.9, this language is intended to ease some of the reporting and paperwork burdens that we're finding with the program. Of the six G&Ts that provide energy to distribution co-ops in the state, only one, Great River Energy, serves distribution cooperatives that are located exclusively in Minnesota. They do serve some load in Wisconsin, but the vast majority of it is in Minnesota. Most of the other cooperatives serve multiple cooperatives in multiple states with really widely varying laws and conservation standards. Just to give you an idea, Dairyland Power, which serves three Minnesota cooperatives down in the southwest part of the state, serves a total of 25 cooperatives in four states. And Basin has 135 members in nine states, but only 12 are located in Minnesota. And because most of the reporting and the planning and the calculating of deemed saving falls on the G&T, This can make it a real burden for some of these for some of the GNTs that don't serve only partially in Minnesota.
Mr. Jensen, we're going to have to get rolling here. We've got three more people.
I'm just coming to my conclusion now. And again, that's just another example that this is one size fits all legislation that doesn't really, you know, fit cooperatives. And again, the biggest difference remains our customer mix experienced in this chart. And lowering the goal is probably the biggest thing that you can do to help us make this system, this program work for our customers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Okay, thank you. Could we have Ms. Taylor and Ms. Lane come up at the same time, please? Hi, Ms. Lane.
Hello.
Hi, Ms. Taylor. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Nancy Lang, Energy Program Director with the Isaac Walton League of America.
I'm Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Program Director at Fresh Energy.
Wonderful. Welcome.
And I realize I stand between you and
that's
adjournment, so I will get about three bullet points in. I just want to echo what Senator Dibble aptly pointed out, is that we are hearing a lot about the cost to large users today, and we are sensitive to that, and we appreciate the opportunity to think through that, both in the House and in the Senate. On the other hand, the savings from SIP, if the PUC had an application for a power plant in front of them that cost as little as energy efficiency does and produced no emissions and created as many jobs as energy efficiency did, I think all the stakeholders in front of the PUC would stand up and say, sign that certificate of need, all the environmentalists and the consumer advocates, and that's really the bottom line behind SIP. We would not support a blanket exemption from reporting requirements for large users that are exempted, either natural gas or electricity. We think that those filings are very important. They are benefiting from SIP programs, and they need to participate at least at that level. I will say that the SIP provisions in House File 1025 significantly weaken Minnesota's SIP. Many provisions, as have been outlined by the previous testifier, do not contribute to energy conservation. I would just remind members that this bill passed in, or the SIP law went into effect in 2010, so it's been in effect for 1 year. There was a large stakeholder process last summer. There were barriers and opportunities for further discussion identified, and I think the process needs to be played out and allowed time to play out. As Linda and I have said, this is a goal. No one goes to jail for not complying with SIP, and the department, I think, is willing to work with utilities of all stripes. We think that every business and ratepayer in Minnesota should benefit from SIP programs, and all utilities should be treated equally under the law. And we appreciate the Senate's approach of realizing the benefits and value of promoting energy efficiency. And by being more thoughtful about how to accommodate some utilities' concerns by only slightly modifying the statute. So I will close at that point and just thank you for your attention and pass it to Linda Taylor.
Hi, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just kind of carrying on from what Nancy said, in terms of bullet points, I guess I'd like to cite some figures.
You're going
to
get
bullet points
room,
until you're really a lot of bullets.
They're traumatized.
The Office of Energy Security, now the Division of Energy Resources, did a compilation recently that shows that over the 15 years of the SIP program prior to 2010, prior to the energy savings goals going into effect, natural gas utilities spent $181 million and achieved a $1 billion savings just on their customer bills. On the electric side, the electric utility spent $898 million and their customers saved $2.5 billion over that period of time. If you think about that, that's a 587% return on investment on the gas utility side. On the electric utility side, that's a 274% in return on investment over 15 years. It's pretty good. There's not very many things you can invest in and get those kinds of returns. In looking at the three major components of SIP that are being discussed today, Fresh Energy has taken a very hard look at the large gas customer opt-out provision. We are very supportive of that provision. We think that, in fact, there's a better argument for the large gas customers to be exempt even than the large electric consumers. And the reason for that is that on the gas side, there's less of the double benefit than there is on the electric side. When we conserve natural gas, we're not buying as much fuel. Maybe eventually we're not building another pipeline or we're not building some other distribution facilities, but we're saving in the hundreds of millions of dollars. When we save on the electric side, we're saving billions of dollars in additional infrastructure that we don't have to build. I think Xcel Energy testified before this committee earlier this session that they have saved, I think it was 9 medium-sized power plants over the life of the SIP program for them. So there's clearly no other investment that we can make in our energy system that gives us as large a return on investment, that produces absolutely no environmental damage, that puts people to work, and that saves us money, makes our businesses more competitive, keeps our families more comfortable in their homes. So I think that there's no other thing that is this important. We are on the second issue, the issue of the permanent and unreviewed exemptions. We are opposed to that provision. And the reason for that is that while large consumers, and in fact all of us, have incentives to be more efficient, there is internal competition for corporate funds. There's internal competition in my family for family funds on what to spend on what. And we need to know that these large customers that are not helping to pay for the system benefits that we're getting from energy efficiency are in fact achieving energy efficiency improvements over time. And whether we do that more simply with less specific reporting requirements, or whether we do it on a BTU in, BTU out basis for some, like the ethanol industry, which would make some sense, we maybe need to streamline those reports. But I think the public needs to know that these companies are, in fact, achieving these things. I think we heard Medtronic testify that they had saved 24%. They had made a 24% energy efficiency improvement. That seems like a very, very good argument to me for letting these large companies figure these things out. But we do need to know that that's going to happen again 10 years from now when the technology improves, et cetera. So we would like to see these folks come in and report. On the third issue, we don't think that gutting the SIP program for co-ops and munis serves the state very well. And that's a bullet point. I can't think of a single reason why farmers and small businesses and residents in greater Minnesota should have access to crummy energy efficiency programs. And that's what this will do. I think that the inequity between being served by a public utility and being served by a cooperative or a municipal utility that, in fact, took the advantages that would be given in this legislation and did not actually engage in very much energy conservation is just unconscionable. I grew up in a very, very rural area in Iowa. I don't know why my family, my grandfather and my father as commercial beekeepers and farmers, should not have had the same access to energy efficiency programs as the people living in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I think we want to be somewhat specific here. By reducing the goal for co-ops and munis, by having the goal, cutting the goal in half for some of them, by allowing load management, which, by the way, has been an historical push-pull in this area. This has been argued for probably 20 years that I've heard it, over the 25 years I've been involved in energy policy around here. Load management can actually save energy. It often does not. It simply shifts from one time of the day to another when it's used. That can be a huge benefit to the co-ops. It can be a huge benefit to customers, but it is not energy savings. So I think we want to be sure that we are, in fact, saving energy. On the issue of allowing unlimited utility side of the meter infrastructure improvements to count towards energy savings, there's a pretty good reason not to do that. And the first reason is that it's a lot more expensive. So per unit that you save, you spend a lot more money. It's going to increase the cost of the SIP program. The second reason, essentially is that utilities should already have the incentive to do this. And in fact, they should be building into their normal maintenance plans, et cetera, infrastructure improvements. What we don't want to do is encourage utilities to shift from a normal maintenance schedule that's paid for through that side of the utility to shifting infrastructure improvements into the SIP program where they raise costs, et cetera. And yes, it doesn't make a lot of difference how you save a kilowatt hour. It's a saved kilowatt hour. But it makes a difference how much it costs, and it makes a difference as to whether or not it would have happened otherwise.
Senator Jungbauer does have a question, and we are going to have to wrap this up. I'm sorry to tell you that. And I would to get Mr. Grant up, too. Do you mind, Senator Jungbauer, or answering a question for Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor, in your testimony, the way you said it, what I was getting out of it, and I'll use Medtronic as an example that you use, and you talked about Medtronic getting 24% savings, and you were saying that we have to be sure that they get that again within 10 years, with new technology and things that come out. And I guess that's my rub, is that do you think, and I'm assuming you do based on your testimony, do you think that this conservation is never ending, that we can always find something else to conserve on? And the only thing I get out of what you're saying is that we're trying to mandate to somebody something that's unknown that may never exist. And my example would be, we've always talked about, since I've been very little, 100 mile to the gallon car. And I'm pretty darn good with cars, and I know how to make cars extremely efficient and get more gas mileage than my neighbor, but you can only do so much, and then it stops. And so everything we're looking at today has this stopping point based on the technology, and the way you're talking is like technology won't stop. We have to change something. So how do we get through that gap when we can't get the 100 miles of the gallon on the car per se, and somebody's done every energy efficiency they can do to their house short of tearing it down and rebuilding it with something they can't afford?
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, I guess I'm going to just talk about how old I am now. I started working for the House of Representatives Research Department in 1985. I started staffing the Regulated Industries Committee there a year or so after that, and did that until 1995. I was Deputy Commissioner for Energy at the Commerce Department from 1999 to 2003. So I've kind of been around this area for a long time. From the first time I remember a discussion of conservation in Minnesota, I've heard that we've done all the conservation we can. We've picked all the low-hanging fruit. It's too expensive. We can't do any more. The statistics simply don't bear that out. In 1987, when we were discussing all of these things, 1988 and 1989, compact fluorescent light bulbs weren't really feasible. People had fluorescent lights, you know, tubes, pretty unpleasant light. We confined ours to the basement. Now we have compact fluorescent lights throughout our house, and I'm guessing in 5 years we're going to have LED lights throughout our house. That technology is too expensive today. It won't be in 5 years. We have no idea what the technology is going to be, but we know the technology is going to get better. We know that there will be opportunities for greater energy efficiency. There have been, for the past 25 years, they have increased dramatically. I expect for the next 25 years they will do the same thing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jumbar, we do have
to. I know. Just a follow-up, though. You did make my point by saying we didn't have compact fluorescents. 5 years later, we may have had them. But if you do all the energy efficiencies that we have available in technology today to something, then you're dead. You're stopped until the next big thing comes out. And that's what I'm hearing from these other folks is, and maybe, just maybe, there's a few people at the end of the line, they can still do things. But if we're really doing the job right, you've got a stagnant point, and you keep trying to push people through that stagnation. So we do have to deal with that issue and look at that seriously.
We're going to let this conversation go on later. That'd be a good one.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it, both of you. Director Grant, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. Let me start by saying how intimidating it is to have two of my immediate predecessors in the room. I guess if we had Mr. Garvey here, we could
round out the
group. I'm going to try and make this short and sweet, starting with the opt-out provisions, both gas and electric. I think what you'll notice in comparing the two in the form that they're in now, the review standards are dramatically different. In the case of gas, there's an opportunity for the department to review relevant information about whether or not a gas customer should be exempt in the first place. There's an opportunity for an every 5-year review, and there is a requirement that those reviews be supported by an independent evaluator who would contribute to that that filing. The case of the electric opt-outs, as I read the language, it gives our department no opportunity other than to approve the filing for opt-out. It eliminates the every 5-year review, and in so doing also eliminates any independent review of those filings. I'll just submit to you that that's a dramatically different review standard for the department, and I don't see on the face of it any reason why that should be the case. As has been indicated, we've worked closely with the gas utilities who've brought this to us. We think that there are reasonable arguments for why, in fairness, since we've had an electric opt-out, we should also allow large gas customers to opt out of the system, given similar circumstances. But I see no reason, Madam Chair and members, why we should go to dropping the standard of review from where it is currently for electric customers in the manner that's been suggested in the House bill. Then turning to the co-op and muni bill that's been proposed in the House, let me just start by saying that I think what Senator Benson has proposed and that you've acted on here is a disarmingly simple and elegant solution to the problem. It gives the department the ability to review and approve a plan from a co-op or muni at less than 1%. And given all of the circumstances that have been relayed to you as the need for the multiple opportunities to reduce the level of both spending and savings in the House bill, this seems to me to be the best approach. Certainly, at least until we're able to review and discuss all of those circumstances more carefully, I think it's certainly the way we would prefer to go. I'm not going to take each of them point by point. That would take too long. Suffice to say that dropping first to 0.75%, then allowing load management at 0.5% to count, then allowing education programs at some unspecified amount to count, we could easily be down in under 0.25% requirement for co-ops and munis. My concern is that that may prevent us from getting cost-effective conservation opportunities in place where they make sense. I'm not here to tell you that in every case, every co-op is going to be able to make the 1% threshold. But do I think they can do better than something south of 0.25%? Yes, I do, based on the record that's already been established in the filings they've been making to the department. So, Madam Chair and members, we have strong concerns about the House language in this area and certainly prefer the Senate's approach.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. And I apologize. We are going to have to wrap this up there as a committee here at 6. But I'm sure you'll have a chance during the conference committee, Director Grant, to express the rest of your opinions. And
happy to do that, Madam Chair.
We did pretty good. Got a lot in. And I appreciate you members staying here. And if you have any questions, maybe we can catch them outside the door, too. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. And we're not sure about Tuesday if there's going to be a meeting. I know there's a lot of conference committees going on. So we'll keep you informed.